Hello, everyone. Thanks for coming to this talk. I've been in the chocolate factory for almost 11 years now, so I can't really remember what real life is like. The majority of that time, I've been in ads SRE, but I've also spent some time on SRE outreach. If my name is familiar to you, it's probably because of the SRE book, as Laura was saying. So the first question we'll start with is, why am I here talking to you about this? I guess that really separates into two questions, which is why this and why me? So why this is easy. This is a really, really big problem. We need to talk about it as a community. Better support for people who are in some sense not the tech culture default is it's a moral issue. It's a majority issue, actually, and it's a business issue in that order, right? It's also an illustration of a factor which I feel is ignored in our industry and nonetheless hugely important in our profession and doesn't get enough attention, which is bias, you know, cognitive bias, unconscious or otherwise. Why me as opposed to why this is a little more complicated. I have been trying to do diversity and inclusion work for a couple of years now. I'd like to think of myself as an ally for folks who are not in the default category. And I've worked mostly within Google on various projects to that end. I guess the proximate cause is that I was asked by Laura to do this, and I was very pleased to help, partially because I firmly believe that this kind of work should also be done by white male, cis, heterosexual folks, etc. Not relegating it to a so-called minority issue. We should be doing things about these problems actively. Really, the central conception is that this problem that we have as an industry is a leadership problem. And we in leadership, therefore, have a responsibility to do something about it. But you probably can't help but notice that while I'm standing on this stage, I'm not exactly exemplifying diverse categories. As we'll see, as I said, I think we need to spread that load. But there is actually a way in which I am a member of a diverse category of some kind, and that is that I'm very tall. What? But what does that have to do with anything? Well, talking about cognitive bias, it turns out that tall people command more attention than short people do. Did you know that? Malcolm Gladwell, and I think there's a paper by Nicola Persico on this, turns out that, apologies for the non-regionalized stats, but 3.9% of the US population is at or above 6'2", which is my height. But an amazing 30% of the Fortune 500 CEOs are at or above that height. So it's a little odd, I mean, just thinking about those numbers, it's a little odd that of all of the people that society could have chosen to populate the boardroom, on average, we picked people who have to bend down to see the cash machine window. Like, is that really how it should be? So, apologies also, because what you're going to get in this talk is a little different from what you thought you were going to get, at least as per the description. Because during the period over which this talk was constructed, it became rather clear that we were not in a position to write a post-mortem about diversity and inclusion in the SRE sense, that it was something a little bit different. It's still relevant to the extent that postmortems in SRE are about understanding what went wrong and how we can improve and what the underlying issues are and how we can directly attack them, et cetera. Those parts are very relevant. It is, on the other hand, not a traditional postmortem in the sense that we have not ended the problem and we still don't fully understand what's going on and what the what completely effective remediation would look like. There is something else it's a bit more like, quite frankly. It's an ongoing incident. So, ongoing for a very, very long time, you could argue decades, I guess. So with that framing, This is an incident response summary document, okay? So we're taking stock of the current situation, we're writing the situation report document, and we're expanding the set of incident responders. And hopefully some of you in the audience will be interested in joining to help out with this incident. So we're going to talk about some of the things that are going on in a chaotic situation. Not everything is well understood, obviously, but there are definitely some issues that are standing out. We're starting to get a handle on root causes, and it's time to get more people from the whole team helping out. Or another way of putting it is to say that this talk assumes that we have moved right to the acceptance phase of the five stages of grief model. Okay, so this is not a finite state machine, and you can bounce around in these various different stages of processing grief or difficulty of some way. But basically, this talk accepts there is a problem. If you don't, I gotta tell you, I disagree. I do think there's a problem. If none of the events in the past while have caused you to reflect, that seems kind of bad, like maybe that didn't need to happen, then I guess we have to have a conversation about basics. And the basics for me are that diversity and inclusion matter. It's a moral issue, as I was saying. Damage is being done to people. It's injustice. I guess the wider fabric of human experience is not well modeled by many of the default approaches that we take. Homogeneity is also an absolutely real business risk, both in design of products, operation of products, etc. And diversity as such leads to better products, risk assessments, business outcomes, all of that. There's a great HBR article on why diverse teams are smarter, which has a lot of details. But if you genuinely want to talk about the basics, we don't really have time to do everything here. I recommend you start with, there's a google.com/diversity, which is our diversity site. There's loads of other places to go to find out more about the area. Another basics question is what exactly we mean when we're talking about diversity and inclusion. For now, I'll confine myself to saying that for the purposes of this talk, we will look at primarily at diversity of gender. That's what we have stats for in Europe, in my experience, in my extremely limited experience, it must be said. There is an industry-wide move, by the way, to use the word, or to start using words, the words diversity and inclusion together. The idea being that actually you could have quite a diverse team, but those folks might not all necessarily be included in what matters, decision making, et cetera. And as a result, it's better to start talking about that. We also don't talk about intersectionality, which is when you're in multiple categories that are non-default. We don't deal with it in detail here. So I also don't want to leave you with the impression that no progress has been made. In my team, in my group, over the past couple of years, we have moved from single-digit percentage representation to double-digit percentage representation, woo-hoo. Anyway, it's not where I'd like it to be, but it is progress of kind. Google as a whole is doing a little better than that across tech in general. Non-tech, much better at 46%, with 25% in leadership positions. So we'll talk a little bit more about what we've done to try to improve this situation later. But one key point I just want to leave you with is distinguishing what's called pipeline work from what's called inclusion retention work. Pipeline is, broadly speaking, improving the supply of diverse folks, and inclusion retention is making sure that when they arrive in your company, they don't leave within like 6 months. So improving the safety of the landing pad is also really key to what we're doing. Okay, so to recap, we're in the middle of an incident, and we know bad things are happening, and we're in a position to make an educated guess as to what the impact is. We're pretty sure, I think, about the impact on individuals generally, like one big factor there is attrition, very painful. Trying to get a feel for the base impact of this on the industry as a whole is pretty difficult. There is a study from a group called the Cahor Center for Social Impact, who have come up with a number of about $16 billion for the total cost of this kind of problem for the industry. I guess that feels right. It's certainly very large. I expect that it's particularly costly for industries like ours, where the ramp-up time for individuals is very long, say 6 months, and where hiring is hard, which makes it all the less understandable why the tech industry would engage or is so prone to driving people, minorities, out of it. There's just like no rational basis for it, really. So we've observed these effects, but why is it happening? Like, unless we understand why, we can't really hope to make it better. So there's a number of fairly obvious bad things going on. Many of the remedies are also correspondingly obvious. We will talk about the remedies in a bit. It is a complicated situation, and there are for sure all kinds of other factors going on. Those are the ones that suggested themselves for this talk. In some ways, the difficulty of this problem is sometimes a matter of latent structure rather than obvious structure, but we'll get on to that in a moment. So culture, obviously a big factor, tech culture. Sometimes overall, even to me, seems like so much of a kind of immovable monolithic block, it's difficult to know where to start in terms of analyzing it. And obviously it's also tied in with mainstream business culture to a certain extent. The tech culture is not alone in how it treats diversity and inclusion. There are other industries that have problems as well. One useful way to think of it, however, is what are the values? What are the implicit or explicit values of tech culture? How do they express themselves? How does that feed its way into what we see happening around us? So the one I choose to highlight here, there are very many others that we could talk about. The one I choose to highlight here is the fact that tech culture values disruption. Okay, so in this view of the world, it values disruption above all things. Like, you're trying to change the world, so to a certain extent, you have to disrupt what's going on previously, right? So it's a strength and a weakness. Yes, to use highfalutin language, startups could probably not even hope to succeed if they weren't slightly obsessive about how much they believed in themselves. And as an ex-business founder myself, I know how reliant on self-belief you gotta be in order to get through the dark times. But the downside is that self-belief is focused on the self. It's not focused on the other. And belief in the power of disruption becomes disruption whatever the cost. We need to change this. We will do it whatever it takes. And destruction then becomes reveled in for its own sake, rather than anything that's linked to a specific business goal. And to a certain extent, anything which is seen to not advance the mission becomes something which is holding it back, like you're either with us or you're against us type of mentality. It's very easy for that to take root. And once it does, you end up in a situation where minorities who are in some sense outside the default can become more easily understood as hindering the mission rather than advancing it. And to a very large extent as well, I think, again, fish in water analogy, something which is sometimes invisible to us, tech culture, addicted to disruption, as discussed, is also about imagining different ways that the world could be, okay, in the broadest possible sense. This is not necessarily something you'd find in accounting or retail sales or horticulture or whatever, right? But it's about building. It's about creating. World-spanning products require you to envisage a new world for them to span. But the world which is imagined is often imagined from the very limited set of experiences that a very limited set of people have. And so tech culture valuing destruction, building in the end product, no matter how it was reached. And this can have a tremendous cost on people. I think also But the reality of internet services in particular means that consumers can often end up using a product without any understanding of how it was constructed or what that cost is really as a totality. So the penalty for retaliation in those circumstances is often, practically speaking, relatively easy to ignore. Like, impunity is a real thing, and it doesn't produce fair outcomes. Impunity does not produce fair outcomes. It's also particularly pronounced for people in leadership positions. So it can be argued, and I agree, that at root this is a leadership problem, because the folks at the top, somewhat isolated from consequences for some of their actions, are not necessarily modeling the behavior that we would say would be advantageous for everyone in the company to model. But as leaders, they attract followers, and human beings imitate other human beings. So we need better leadership on this issue. There are, of course, fairly obvious wider social factors at work here, widespread misogyny, racism, et cetera, et cetera. But I'll call out one specific factor for this slide, which is language and microaggressions. Okay, so these are very, very common, but are especially pernicious in environments where there's small minorities. Okay, that's an oxymoron in some way. So what are microaggressions? In this case, they're events, typically things which are said or done, which are small in size but discriminatory in some way, and usually repeated over and over again. There's kind of like a small background radiation of microaggressions. The classic one is what you call people, groups of people. So Douglas Hofstadter, well-known author, someone I admire greatly, wrote an article in 1985, about the difficulties of the word guys. I try not to use that myself. And there are other phrases which are common in documentation, et cetera, for which there are probably better replacements that don't reinforce stereotyped thinking. And it can be as simple as, for example, quote, when the programmer calls the API, his account will be billed, end quote. Yeah? So an easy replacement for that is when the programmer calls the API, their account will be billed. Something I don't like a lot myself, quotes, this product is so simple your mom could use it. Right? Actually, my mom's kind of smart, and even if she wasn't, it's your responsibility to make the product easy to use, not hers. So it's so simple that anyone could use it, or isn't, as is more commonly the case. Quotes, I'll make a dumbed-down version so those humanities graduates in marketing will get it, end quote. Quote, I'll make a version without technical jargon so that marketing can understand it. So I should point out that this is hard and not everyone gets it right all of the time. I certainly get it wrong. Loads of times I've committed, I guess, thousands of microaggressions in my life, and there are thousands waiting yet to be committed. But there is value in trying to avoid them. For example, I feel I should confess in front of this intimate audience that I have, in fact, mansplained mansplaining to a woman, which was awesome. But sometimes these things are not necessarily super clear to you unless you're on the receiving end of them. For example, I was also talking to a colleague a large number of years ago, I won't say who or what company, but he expressed frustration with Ireland, where he was staying temporarily, with Ireland as a whole, and said that how everything worked was such a disaster that he'd invented a new phrase for totally messing something up, which was called, quotes, to really Irish something up, end quotes. He then talked about how the transport system was really Irished up, how the database was Irished up and needed to be restored, and so on and so forth. So, all right, maybe that's more of a macro aggression rather than a micro aggression. But it was certainly something that made me uncomfortable as a result of a use of language because I was stereotyped. I was lumped in with a group like, actually, I don't think it's quite that bad. All right, maybe the transport system, like, I'll give you that one, but not the other stuff. So, moving on, I wish this wasn't the case, actually, but there's a very large amount of evidence suggesting that Anti-woman bias in particular reflects itself pretty strongly in some of the communities that gave rise to SRE, or overlap with SRE in some way. For example, there is a First Monday article called quotes free as in sexist, end quotes, by Joseph Regal, which has numerous examples of early Linux culture being pretty exclusionist to women, whether deliberate or not. Another data point is the gender bias in open source study, which shows that patches from women with a clearly identifiable gendered, female gendered name get accepted at a rate approximately 10% lower than patches from accounts with male names over 1.4 million contributors. So there's more, unfortunately. So a little bit related to the tech culture slide, where in particular startups, like everyone's supposed to give everything to the company. I recall multiple 24-hour days back then as well. The presumption is therefore that no one has significant responsibilities to care for anyone else, right? Whether young or old. And the presumption is everyone is strong or has a support system for them of some kind. The reality, of course, is that everyone is weak. Eventually, right, it's just a matter of time. In the nicest possible way, we're all gonna get sick and old, and so on. Why is this basic human fact not more accommodated? There is a talk on this on Friday, I believe, by Emily, on the cult of strength, goes into it a bit more detail. I guess how this feeds into the point of, or the question around work policies and flexible work policies is that these policies, presenteeism, have you ever had a presenteeist boss? You have to be at your desk by 9 o'clock typing away, even if it's got like nothing to do with your actual job. The previous, frankly ridiculous parental leave given, the statutory leave until comparatively recently in Ireland for male parents. Anyone know what that was? 0 days. 0 days statutory entitlement to leave. All right, your kid's born during lunchtime, hopefully. Then you head back to work. Okay, not good. So again, there's structural bias, which is pushing folks out of the workforce, pushing women proportionally more out of the workforce, in particular, for obvious reasons. So family-friendly policies, facilitating folks who have to care for others, allowing folks to work remotely, and so on. Some companies are strangely resistant to this, despite, for example, remote work or VC being facilitated by tech company products and approaches. It's not clear to me why this is the case. So marketing. Okay, so marketing works and humans are suggestible. Anyone disagree? Excellent. So it certainly works in the aggregate. One of the interesting things about the marketing of computer science is how it changed over the years, particularly in the spread from the 60s to the left of this slide to the 80s to the right of this slide. So exhibit A is at least one point in the 60s, women turned up in an advert for something related to computers, and they were a legitimate consumer of the services, right? They were not performing some other role. So yes, it's paternalistic in the extreme, and also, how are you actually gonna find room for that recipe computer in your kitchen? I'm not sure. But at least women are present in the frame. However, during the 80s, when we transitioned to the home computer market, and there was a push to market stuff to this new wave of adopters, usually the first contact somebody had with computing technology at that time became marketed to boys rather than girls. And so you have the result on the right. Like not terribly diverse, although one person has glasses. So what we got? Okay, so this is a graph from the National Science Foundation, I believe, via NPR, National Public Radio in the States. Probably loads of you have seen this. But it seems clear that part of the reason why we have this inflection in the graph, why this take-up of computer science by women, why it fell, is partially because we started telling the story. And stories are really, really powerful for many human beings. They started telling the story that it wasn't for them, wasn't for women. This meant that when these cohorts got to college, the folks who had been using home computers had some degree of familiarity, had some kind of leg up, and that ended up reflecting itself in expectations about performance. So there's an excerpt from the show, which I think is illustrative. So when Ordonez got to Johns Hopkins University in the 80s, she figured she would study computer science or electrical engineering. Then she took her first intro class and found that most of her male classmates were way ahead of her because they'd been growing up playing with computers, essentially. Quote, I remember this one time I asked a question and the professor stopped and looked at me and said, you should know that by now, she recalls. Quote, and I thought, I am never going to excel, not in this environment. So again, there is hope here. Marketing can be used also to improve things. For example, CMU, Pennsylvania, in Pittsburgh in the States, now has 48% women representation in their incoming computer science class. That is a fantastic number. It does take effort. I would also just note in passing, by the way, the difficulty that this graph presents for those convinced that the ignorant, sloppy, and ultimately uninteresting theory of biological essentialism is the reason for the state of things that we see today. It can't be because it was different in the past. So a quick quiz. Anyone know what this is? Bletchley Park, very good. Okay, so it's a picture of Bletchley Park during WW2, Allied forces created what has an excellent claim to being one of the world's first stored program computers, a code-cracking machine called Colossus. Second quick quiz, does anyone know the unit in which IBM, at around about this time, measured work done on manufacturing computers in the UK? Not lines of code. Any ideas?
Human computer equivalent.
I'll tell you, it is the rarely encountered unit, girl hours. Also leading to the even more rarely encountered unit, kilo girl hours apparently. So, yes, it's not man hours, it's girl hours, and it's not just the government being paternalistic and condescending and sexist, although it is. Why? It's because of the prevalence of women in computer work at that time, working on these systems in particular, because of the sheer numbers of them. At the end of the war, the 10 Colossus machines were cared for by 300 women staff from the Women's Royal Navy Service, also known as WRENS. So I'd like to think we've improved our ratio of machine to managing person over time, but this is obviously fairly early days. The other thing that strikes me, it's kind of a by-the-by, but the other thing that strikes me about the work that the women were doing with these machines at the time is how really very similar to SRE work it is. So there's a great book called Programmed Inequality and a number of other studies of this period of history. But there's a couple of wonderful quotes about what people are doing at this time, which really resonated for me. The first one is, quote, one early machine was designed by Max Newman and deployed in June 43, partially electronic but mainly relay-based. This machine could compare two high-speed tapes of encoded information using a photoelectric reader. Unfortunately, it was neither fast enough nor reliable enough. The same data fed through twice in a row might produce a different result each time. The WRENS operators who struggled to make it work named it the Heath Robinson after the rickety and comically pointless machinery of the cartoonist Heath Robinson, the British analog of Rube Goldberg. So that reminds me of some things I've worked with in the past, yes. Quotes, like many other women in Bletchley's data processing office, Colossus operators worked around the clock in 3 8-hour shifts, alternating shifts on a weekly basis. Each woman was allowed to leave only one weekend a month. Many worked extra hours to the point of exhaustion, especially during times of exceptional need. Resonate with anyone? Okay. Quotes, another woman, Margaret Bullen, came forward the same year to talk about how she and other women wired up one of the Colossus machines and soldered together its connections in order to prepare it for the Wrens to use it, showing that despite previous assumptions, women did perform maintenance and engineering work at the park. If you've ever felt that sometimes your colleagues don't feel you do engineering work as opposed to operational work, possibly resonates with you as well. I guess there's two others. Quotes, in the machine rooms, the women who worked as registrars were critical to successful, efficient code breaking. Their job was to record and schedule the computer's work and work assignments so that the problems to be solved were arranged in order of priority and would also flow onto the machines at a constant rate to maximize the available computer time. The registrars had some of the most important work at the park. They needed to quickly solve ever-changing logistical and operational problems under extreme time pressure, also known as cluster scheduling. Okay? And one other final one. Quotes, initially operating Colossus under the direction of a cryptographer who told them the settings required for the run, the Wrens members soon took on responsibility for finding the right settings themselves, quotes, freeing the cryptographer for more important work, end quotes. So a direct relevance to some developer team SRE interactions I have had in the past. So it seems clear to me, at least at the time, that a lot of our kind of work was being done then successfully by massive numbers of women. So how do we get from a situation where things are measured in girl hours to the situation that pertains today? The general numbers about tech industry diversity, I guess, a bit out of date because studies from 2015, but the general pattern still approximately holds. It isn't a hugely fair comparison for a number of reasons. I guess raw workplace participation numbers are far from everything. Like this, it's not the sole metric you would care about. Better support for minorities, obviously, when they're in the industry is key. But in the previous slide, for example, you could argue that despite talking up the contribution of women, I've successfully ignored the fact that there happened to be a war going on and most of the men were out there fighting that war, which would be enough to account for why women had to do that job temporarily. Well, sure. Right? But actually, the real story is what happened after the war ended and everyone went home, which is that it was the law at that time, it was against the law for married women to work in the civil service. And very few women were able to either successfully overturn, flout, ignore, or work around that ban. A ban which was only rescinded in 1946 for the Home Civil Service and 1973 for the Foreign Service. And just in case you think I'm coming over all superior, until July 1973 in Ireland. So a related and interesting note is this is not the first transition from a community and an industry that's female-dominated to one that's male-dominated. There was an example going around recently about brewing, which in, I think, medieval times was female-dominated and then transitioned. Anyway, it's a whirlwind tour of the history of computing through a particular lens. What could we do about it, right? How can we fix these things? Is it condemned to be bad forever? No, we are going to have good vibes only from this point on, okay? So we can make progress on this incident. And here are a few suggestions for things to do. So, a basic one, unconscious bias training, allowing people to understand that, in fact, they do have cognitive bias and that this is almost certainly reflecting itself in day-to-day conduct. I think we have a free version on YouTube, but there's actually a lot of training out there. It's particularly useful for hiring and for promotions. And we just recently announced internally that all of the technical infrastructure promotion committees will have to take special training on unconscious bias in order to eliminate this at the assessment of importance and impact of work stage. So sponsorship and mentoring and allies. Just very briefly, mentoring is somebody senior being available for somebody junior in order to bounce ideas off and be a kind of a time-limited cheerleader, I guess. Sponsorship is actually mentioning their name. You know, a conversation crops up, who are we going to find to lead Project X? And a sponsor for somebody says, well, have you thought about this other person over here? It's deliberately trying to increase visibility. Very powerful technique. And there's a lot of resources out there for what you can do, an ADA initiative program in particular. You can try and create an inclusive culture, okay? So that includes not telling your Irish coworkers that you think the Irish transport system is really Irished up, but it also includes one specific thing I want to call out there towards second from the bottom, which is kind of respect post-mortem. In SRE, we are very disciplined about how we try and improve things, and there's a Zoogler now, ex-Googler, by the name of Bridget Spitznagel, who did a respect post-mortem for an incident or a number of incidents in Google, which actually, like, it helps stuff, because in the respect post-mortem, you have an action item saying, oh, we don't have an easy way to refer people to how bias reflects itself in a kind of a relatively scientifically objective fashion. We should have easy access to that kind of resource, and that's the kind of action item you can put together out of a respect post-mortem. So it's a bit, it's interesting to me that despite there being very, very many constraints on behavior which attempt to enforce equal treatment under the law, we still see the behavior that we do. And one part of this is, how easy is it for people to access redress? Okay, and that's part of what I think Susan Fowler's legal team is working on, talking to the US Supreme Court about trying to get arbitration, compulsory arbitration removed. But also education about what you can do, education about what you're entitled to, is incredibly important so that people know what their rights are. In terms of access to redress before the courts, Google has a kind of out-of-band escalation process where people can go to a well-known set of managers and get them to listen to problem reports, and it avoids a potentially difficult kind of manager-employee relationship. So that's been quite useful as well. Marketing, the job ads. The first SRE job ad, I believe, starts off with, quote, are you part ace coder, comma, part adrenaline junkie, question mark, end quote. No, I'm not. But nonetheless, I managed to get hired somehow. So there's actually some software out there which will look at your job ad language and make some recommendations about words you could switch out. Alcohol culture. This is a big one, apparently, in SRE. I don't know. I'm a teetotaler. I never go to any of those events. So possibly my suggestion would be use tea instead. Like, I'm very fond of tea. Tea is nice. Have tea. Tanya said it best, I think. And also, to a certain extent, referring back to adrenaline junkie pit stop culture. Like, this is not actually necessarily how we want to present ourselves or even what we should aspire to be. And better management, like coming back to the leadership question, like we should invest in managers. I've so much sympathy for engineering leaders who have been kind of thrust into management for one reason or another, and you don't really know what to do or how to do it, but they've got to keep the side up somehow, so let's just go do it. You need training, you need to invest, you need to be disciplined about these things operationally in the way that SRE is. You need to track results, you need to have visibility, you need to respond when there's a problem. All of these things. And finally, don't levy the diversity tax. Don't make this work just the responsibility of the diverse people. It is a majority issue. It is something we have to work on. And leadership shouldn't expect that, okay? And really, finally, we should start to track metrics on things other than gender as well, so we can have a more fully flavored conversation about this and intersectionality. And so I'll end by saying it's appropriate to start asking for help in this incident. The next shift is going to be challenging, but we'll get there in the end, I'm confident. We have a good handle on some of the root causes. We have some suggestions for things to do. We just need not to lose discipline. We need to drive it to resolution. Thank you very much.